Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Delighted you're all able to make it today, and delighted to see so many of our excellent students who are focusing on these great topics. I'm going to be the moderator today, and I'm sure that will not involve any physical restraint of what goes on here, but I will be trying to play the role a little bit like the guy in the NFL games who comes on with a measuring stick, which I've always wanted to, you probably know that. And I will therefore try and sort of pick up some loose ends, make sure our rules are followed, and perhaps direct the discussion in different directions. Just a short personal note, I did about 35 years ago take a ferry from the UK to Santander from Plymouth. So there perhaps is an old connection there which is being revived today. Our topic today, and delighted to have our experts addressing it, Cuba-US relations. And I'm sure you're all aware that it's not just in Bay State Road where there's an interest in US-Cuba relations. If you've been getting the New York Times, the Washington Post the last few weeks, there have been numerous editorials on different issues of US-Cuba. There have been the elections, of course, just the last week, and we can look at some of the implications, immediate implications of those. Some of the questions I hope we'll address, and I'm sure will be in the back of your own minds, is 55, 56 years since the revolution, what would normal relations between the US and Cuba look like? What is the future of Cubans and Cuban Americans? You probably know that all Cuban Americans can now travel freely, send largely whatever they want in money terms to their families in Cuba, and are de facto beginning to invest in businesses in Cuba. So there's plenty to look at. And the fascination of this subject, I think, in my point of view, knows no ends. And I'll end with another story with NFL significance, which might surprise you. The first game that the University of Miami Hurricanes American football team played in 1926, just after they'd been christened the Hurricanes, was against the University of Havana. So the two countries have been enmeshed closely for many decades. They've, of course, been through a period of hostility, of frozen relations de facto for many years, and now the future is there to be made. So without further ado, I'll introduce Stephen Kinzer, who you've got his bio. He is, of course, a very well-traveled, very well-informed journalist on Latin America. He's visited Cuba. He took a group of Boston University communications students there just last year, so he's got very recent knowledge of it. And then we'll go in the order of Professor Haywood and Professor Keller. So thank you very much, and Stephen, over to you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Ambassador. It's great to be back on campus. It's nice to hear that the red motif is still strong here. Now, when I was a student, I used to go into that building right across the street and wait for the appointments with my professor, Howard Zinn. So we were red even then. Maybe that's why I got this distorted idea that I could try to see the world in a new way and not just accept what was written in history books. It all started right across the street here. I had to think with a little bit of a sobering realization that I made my first visit to Cuba 40 years ago. I came there in 1974. I want to tell you I was an infant being carried in my parents' arms. Wasn't quite that young, but still it was a remarkable moment. And then in the following 10 years, from 1974 to 84, I was there every year, so I made 10 trips over those 10 years. And then there was a gap. I had a few other little things to do, but I've been back then several times in recent years. So I've managed to see, I showed up at a time when the revolutionary effervescence was still there, not maybe as intense as it would have been in 1962, but there was still a lot of feeling. And when I got back 5 years ago, for the first time after 25 years or something, and started hearing the country's leader referred to as El Viejo, it was a big shock for me to realize how much time had passed. There's a tremendous change going on in Cuba today. I think that's quite obvious. Cuba's opening up to the world, not necessarily because it wants to do it, but the world is crashing into Cuba, whether it's in the area of business or sports, culture. In every area, Cuba's isolation is fading away, and I think that has some very positive aspects, but they're not all positive. It's always been a fear of the Cuban Revolution that once the social structure that the revolution imposed began to fade or crumble, the distortions of society would become more intense, and you'd have the equality of society would begin to fade away, and that's happening. It's still at a relatively low level, thanks to government restrictions. I think the government does fear that if the lid was lifted tomorrow and every business could come in and do what it wanted there, just like it can do in Haiti or the Dominican Republic, that Cuba would quickly be overwhelmed and that most of the advances of the revolution would be destroyed. And I think that's probably true. Nonetheless, it would certainly open up a whole new field of opportunities for Cubans. So the social distortion of normal capitalist life is beginning to be seen in Cuba. I have seen now, I've gone down streets where it seems like every house has a little private business. They've got a little table outside, they're selling something, they're fixing something, they'll unblock your cell phones for you. But there's a lot of frustration that comes with this because the businesses are kept so small. They call them bonsai businesses, like those little plants, because they're allowed to grow, but they have to be kept very small. I met a guy who was selling books in a square in Havana, and he has a cell phone with him, and he told me that he actually has another store, but this is not allowed. So he has an assistant in that other store, and if a policeman or somebody shows up, the assistant is to say, oh, he's just in the back, hey, he's in the bathroom, and then go back and quickly call him. He'll run over to pretend that he's actually managing that store and he has no other place. Multiply that times many thousands and you see some of the frustrations that are coming into Cuba. Another difference has to do with whether you have relatives outside or not. So this is now a big division. If you have relatives outside, you have access to hard currency, you can live a completely different life from people who don't. Also, the kind of job you have in Cuba makes a huge difference now. I ran into people who told me, mothers in Cuba now tell their children, don't become a doctor, don't become an engineer. See if you can get a job as a waiter. Could you become a nightclub hostess? That would be a really good job. And it's true. Those people make much more money than people who are productive for society. So that's also a difficult challenge I think Cubans are facing. Frustration that I think Cubans are having is reflected in what you've seen in the last few months. The number of balseros, people trying to leave illegally, is increasing. You are seeing just enough freedom to give people a taste of what they would like to have, and that's always a dangerous situation. I don't sense that that's in it, that there's a great deal of political instability there. I think the Cubans are very aware of what they've achieved, and they know what life is like in Guatemala and Haiti and other neighbors, and so they are aware that they have some things that are important to preserve. On the other hand, a sense I got from many younger people is, I only have one life. I don't want to live it under this restrictive environment. I want to get somewhere where I can fulfill myself in these few years that I have on this earth. Now, in April, as you all know, Obama will be going to a summit, we presume, in Panama, in which this question will be at the top of the agenda. As we heard at the beginning, the New York Times has now embraced this cause with a fervor that I find truly remarkable. They say there's no zealot like a converted sinner. So after 50 years, the New York Times has finally decided that this is a foolish foreign policy. I think it might qualify our embargo as the dumbest foreign policy of all the ones we have. And there's a lot of competition in that department. It's so self-defeating, and it really doesn't promote our own interests. So we're still engaged in Cuba in some hostile ways. You know, we're still spending money to destabilize Cuba through the Helms-Burton Act and other covert projects. I find this quite bizarre, since as we look around the world, we find that instability is the great problem in the world. Why would we like to take a country that's already stable and add it to the list of the countries that are in chaos, especially one that's right on our doorstep? So I find this project very self-defeating and foolish for the United States. I see some problems ahead as Cuba tries to figure out a mechanism for bringing in foreign investment without upsetting the political and social system. What I would envision is a system in which foreigners are allowed to invest, even directly, but they would have to have Cuban partners, and the Cuban partners would probably be, in a large majority of cases, the army. So the army will be the place, the institution that guarantees, we'll get you the land, we get you the labor force, we'll make sure you don't have any problems with the government, and then you pay us what you want to pay your workers, and then we take a share, and we'll pay the workers what we want. So the capital would come from outside, and the domestic partner would have to be somebody with connections strongly to the government, and I think the army would be the logical institution. So I would see that maybe as the next kind of model for Cuban-style capitalism, if you want to call it that. Question that I still keep in my mind is, where are we going now in the embargo and U.S.-Cuban relations? Cuba has a strange place in the American imagination. In some ways, I compare it to Iran, although we've only hated Iran for 35 years. It's been 55 with Cuba. These are places that we've ceased to appreciate as individual countries. They're just general tropes. They're examples of the force of barbarism and repression and backwardness that's always threatening civilization in the world. So we've lost track of what Cuba actually is. We just see it as the trace of a hostile enemy. But a whole generation, which is your generation, has grown up not knowing Cuba as an enemy at all. In fact, Cuba really doesn't count for much of anything now. It's hard to imagine, for those of you that are younger, that Cuba was a massive power in the world. And that's why the embargo seems so odd and so out of time at this place. I sometimes wonder, if we finally get around to lifting the embargo at this point, will it matter? Does anybody care anymore? Of course, there will be things, some certain kinds of investment and communication and interchange between these countries will be facilitated. But I think a lifting of the embargo 20 or 30 years ago would have been a huge event for Cuba, for the United States, for Latin America, and for the world. Now I don't think it is anymore. So although I still hope it happens, I have seen Cuba, in the times that since I've been going there, decline in importance in the world tremendously. And I think that might be a good thing for Cuba. What Cuba needs is a dose of normality. And I think they're trying to figure out what that would be. Normality does not mean transforming itself into a version of Jamaica or the Haiti or the Dominican Republic or the United States. They have to find some framework in which they can preserve the good they've achieved and try to bring in the good that they've kept outside. That's the challenge that they have, and I think our job as Americans is to realize that a stable and confident Cuba is good for us. A destabilized and unhappy and turbulent Cuba is bad for us. That ought to be the principle that guides our policy.
All right, very good. Thank you, Stephen. We'll have the presentations first and then hopefully have a good deal of time for questions. So thank you, Linda.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Sandan, for this on and for allowing me to sort of a little time to reflect. I first came to Cuba, actually not in Cuba, but in Angola, where I was a cooperant in 1979-80, after having been accused of really being a CIA spy and waiting 18 months for my visa, hung up in Lisbon in Portugal, but it's okay, I did a lot more research that and learned Portuguese, so that was the thing. But three weeks after I arrived in Angola, one evening I was in the Hotel Global and I heard the solemn playing of music over on the radio, and it was the announcement that the leader, Agostinho Neto, had died, and that all revolutionaries, this was a revolutionary time, this is 1979, should come out to view the body. So I, as a good revolutionary and a student of history, modern history, took my notebook, got up 4 o'clock in the morning, and I went to stand up on that line. And it was the first time that I actually saw all the Cubans who were in Angola. I'd seen them because they came to the store, and I saw them in the street. And I also knew that if I had malaria, which I got every month, I could go to one of the clinics and I would get an injection so that my fever, which put up to a hand, it was the Ebola of the time. In any case, after having stayed in the line between from 4 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock, I finally got to the door of the entrance to the place where his body was, Nato's body, lay. And in the meantime, once the sun came out, I took out my notebook and I was just writing notes of all the different, the juventude, different groups, women's groups, you know, and I was absolutely oblivious that anyone had been looking at me. And as I was about actually to get my time to enter to see the body lying in state, I heard someone say, "Pada!" And I looked around and there were three young men with guns in my face. Well, I'd never seen a gun before. I'm from the Caribbean. We don't have guns there. I'm not a gun culture. So immediately I sort of froze. I actually couldn't speak because all my saliva, everything that allows you to speak, stopped. And the young men were asking me who I am in Portuguese. Now I'm still, my Portuguese was better than theirs because they're 17-year-old country kids who have never spoken Portuguese and they're now in Luanda protecting shops and, you know, being guards and so on. And I said, I know I couldn't say American. I was a foreign student at the time, but I couldn't say American. So I said, Trinidad y Tobago, Trinidad and Tobago. And the guy said, Lebanon, because that's the only thing that he knew in reference to foreigners, you know, Lebanon. I said, no. Petra de Cuba, because all the Cubans were next to me and they were getting to go in while I'm outside here. Okay? Petra de Cuba. Well, that didn't help. I was kept in the back room for, for 4 hours. In any case, that was my introduction to Cuba because I had to use Cuba as a point of reference to save myself. My second real introduction was when I got typhoid fever. And I was sent from the military hospital. I got sick, at least the sort of dizziness began a morning of a Monday morning. And I was the whole, you know, taken to ambulance, carried to the doctor, to the emergency military hospital. And for the whole 24 hours, the doctors were working on, I didn't know which doctors there were. And there were Cuban doctors. The end of my stay there was, I had to be sent to a hospital for tropical diseases, where I stayed 3 weeks. So I always, from that time, sought out the Cubans who were there to find out more about why you're here. So I met Cuban engineers. This is 1979-80. I spent a whole year there. And I always thought, you know, when... Sometime I'm going to be writing about Cuba in Angola because, I had read and heard all about the military, and then I didn't hear about the other people, all the teachers and all the doctors and all the, I didn't know at the time until this summer when I was interviewing a 77-year-old architect, the first Cuban architect, Afro-Cuban, that in fact he was there at that time. And was helping to reconstruct and design buildings. So therefore, right now, what I've done is I'm writing a book on the memory of, you know, a certain queen. I've written a biography of the queen, and then I have a book on her memory, which is remembered in Brazil. I said, look, I'm going to add a chapter of that book and bring the Cuban story in. So as I've been doing more research, and I have to thank my freshman assistant here who is working with me this semester, other students have worked with me over here. What I'm trying to do is to understand Cuba's use of soft power. And that soft power went parallel to its use of hard power. So whereas it had the military in the beginning, along with the military, was this kind of a thinking of this, of reconstruction. Obviously, it served you. And, you know, if you're a cynic, you'll say this was all part of the socialist design. Or, you know, and I know that. But I also have to speak to the Cubans who, one Cuban said, you know, Afro-Cuban said, when I was drafted to go to Cuba, to go to Angola, I went to my, and he was a Palo Monte, he was of that Santeria, you know, Palo Monte, some of the Afro, you know, Afro-American religions. And he said, you know what, I went to my padre, and I said, I'm going, you know, I've been drafted now, I'm going to Angola. Apparently, you didn't go and speak to anyone when you were recruited for Angola, especially in the early years. But he said he had to speak to his religious, you know, leader. And you know, he told him, he said, that's good. You're going back to the motherland. And you are going to bring to me anything from the ground. Bring to me anything that you can find. Because that is the strongest element in our religion. So it seems to me that we have to think of that dimension. Today, there are so many Cubans who are going to Angola to work. Some of them still part of the government. But some of them, one of them, I met the doctor in Mbanza, Congo. And I had fever again. I don't know, the fever swallowed me. I'm supposed to be an African descendant, don't get any malaria, I end up getting, it's a European in me, I have about 14%, that's what is bothering me. But in any case, what I see is that, in some respects, there are elements there that sort of draw Cuba. And I'm not saying that Cuba isn't a communist, socialist, I've gone for the last, from 2011, and I'm in between, I'm a Caribbean. So I come to the Caribbean and I'm in my glory. I go to Cuba, I say, I could live here. And the energy that you find, you know, there, people, you know, buying and selling houses, you know, right with pieces of paper, you know, that, you know, exchanging, but still the guy who comes and records it, you know, would be around soon. But it's there, there's something going on. And I'm telling myself, where is America here? The Spanish, and I know Santander, okay, I stayed in your hotel, you know what, some of the Spanish hotel, 50-50, right? The Italians are there, everybody, even the Canadians, and I'm looking for the Americans, and where are they? Few students from some liberal college, right there. We got to do better than that, man, because we are losing out. This is Caribbean America. We're part of this larger thing. And to still, I spoke last night with a Cuban. Now, I was at the store buying something. I said, I don't have a suit. This is not the suit, by the way. Didn't wear it. It's too warm. But anyhow, the clerk is attending to me. And I said, she looks Cuban. So I just started talking to her in Spanish. Oh, habla español. And she said, and I said, Italiana, because she also looks it. Oh, she's Italian descent, but she's from Cuba. And for 15 minutes, she's not paying attention to her stuff. She begins talking to me about Cuba. And she said, you know, my husband would really like to talk to you. I gave her my card. I said, have him call. Last night, for an hour and a half, this Cuban American who left, I think he said in 1970, talked to me. And you know, the end result of that conversation, he said, you know what we want? We want two things. We cannot go back, right? We cannot go back to 59 or 58 or 50, you know? We have to start from now, but there are some things that my generation needs. We need the Cuban government to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for your grandfather who we sent to prison just because he didn't agree with me. all that, I was thinking of South Africa and truth and reconciliation. So there are some things we have to think about once we talk about, yes, there's American reality, but there also is a Cuban reality. There are a lot of different contradictory things. And we've got to have students and others who study society, who begin to tease out how do we develop, you know what I mean, to get this people to people, because that's the only thing. And that people to people should include Cuban Americans. The young man I met on the plane coming back 2 years ago, 12 years, and he has a Castro shirt and hat. I said, how can you, your mother allow you to wear Castro shirt? He said, oh, I've gone down the 5 times. Oh, my mother hasn't gone, or my granny hasn't gone, but they send me everything. This is the Cuban that we are talking about. This is the Cuban American, that young generation, whose parents have told them about Cuba, and who Cuba have to become a reality, you know, possessed again. And they know their cousins and their relatives there, right? So I think all we plan with the American, you know, dimension and the politics of it, we got to also think about the social implications, the culture, because these are strong. This is what people remember. They don't remember all the politics. They remember the social things of it. What did I hear about that old Congo that they said, Congo proverb that we had in Cuba? That's what kicks in when you say, what's my culture? So for me, any study and any realignment have to take reality of Cuban reality, of the different populations today, by the way, and I don't know if you know that, if you are Spanish Cuban, you have your Spanish Cuban society, very active. If you're an Italian Cuban, you have that as well. So then I asked the Afros, and I said, well, where is the Afro-Cubans? Oh, no. We don't have, they don't let us have that because that's the unstable thing. Okay? It's very fascinating. So when you think about how much plans you have and how much what we do to change it, think about all layers of Cuban society. Cuba is a mixed society, but Cuba is also a class society, and Cuba is also an elitist versus outsider. So I'm going to leave you with that right now. Thank you.
All right. Well, my personal history with Cuba doesn't go back quite that far.
Nor does your life.
Nor does my life, to be frank. But I am a historian, and I study U.S.-Cuban relations in the context of wider inter-American relations, of hemispheric ones. And so what I study is the 1960s, in the period when Cuba was originally isolated, and when the rest of the countries of Latin America cut relations with Cuba, including the U.S., and actually Mexico was the only one that didn't cut relations. So at that point, Cuba was very isolated, and this was a U.S.-directed policy that a lot of other countries were very much in favor of, this idea of trying to isolate Cuba, undermine Castro's influence in the hemisphere, get him to stop intervening in other countries, cut off their kind of symbolic influence as well. And that strategy lasted for a long time. And on the part of the U.S., it's our current strategy still. And ironically, I would argue that now this same old strategy that was meant to isolate and undermine Castro's influence is now currently doing that to us, doing that to the United States. It's isolating us. It's undermining our influence in the hemisphere. And I would argue that we could really actually learn from some other countries in the hemisphere about ways to improve our relations with Cuba and ways to take advantage of some of our opportunities to regain our leadership in the hemisphere. And so I'm going to look at a couple of different countries. First of all, Mexico, that's the country I study. So like I said, Mexico was the only Latin American country that never cut relations with Cuba. And that was really, it helped the Mexican government strengthen its rule at home and then also its influence abroad, this special relationship that they had with Cuba. And this special relationship continues. It's changed over time, but it's still there. The two countries have a very strong history of relations, of cultural exchange, of trade, of political exchanges. And currently, now that Cuba's opening its economy a little bit to investment, like Stephen was saying, a lot of Mexican companies are taking advantage of that opportunity, and the Mexican government's encouraging it. So, for example, just last week, Cuba and Mexico announced that they are forming, working together to create a mixed company that will produce flexible packaging for products. And so this company will be able to meet, they estimate, about 80% of the internal demand within Cuba, and then also be able to meet a lot of export demand. And so in this way, both Mexico and Cuba are working together to start rebuilding and strengthening Cuba's economy, but it's also helping Mexico as well. It's an opportunity for investment. Another country that is really taking advantage of these changes that Cuba is pursuing is Brazil. And so Brazil, another one of the leaders of Latin America, recently provided about $600 million to Cuba to help them build this new deep water port right near Havana. And so this is a zone that Cuba is trying to build to encourage international trade and investment. And Brazil has played a leading role in this. So they helped make this new port possible. And they're also starting to invest in more Cuban businesses as well, especially in this area. And especially also, interestingly, in the area of health. And so some of you may have heard that Cuba, you know, has this huge health diplomacy, medical diplomacy program, and Brazil is one of the recipients of Cuban doctors. And so right now, there's a partnership between the Brazilian and Cuban governments. There's about 11,000 Cuban doctors working in Brazil, and they've provided medical attention to areas where most people don't have access to attention, rural areas, really poor areas. About 50 million poor Brazilians have benefited from this relationship with Cuba, and it's also been a huge source of hard currency for the Cuban government and hopefully for some of those doctors as well. There's also a lot of cooperation between Brazil and Cuba in biotechnology. And so one of these areas that Cuba is really strong in, medical research, medical technology, the Brazilians are working with them now to strengthen that and to do things like spread new medicines that the Cubans have developed and haven't been able to produce in mass. So they're building new factories in Brazil to produce, for example, one drug that the Cubans created to treat anemia. And so making these huge advances in medicine through international cooperative efforts. They're also working together to develop new compounds for cancer therapy. And so doing these really important humanistic efforts as well, not just the benefit Brazil or Cuba, but that will benefit people across the Americas and around the world. And then furthermore, Cuba is taking advantage of its relations with all these countries to build its reputation as a leader in the hemisphere. So whereas the U.S. used to be, and still is in many respects, a leader in the hemisphere, I would argue that Cuba is still important and becoming increasingly important. And one example of that is the fact that Havana has been hosting these negotiations between the Colombian government and the FARC group. And they've been doing that for about 2 years, and it's been useful not just for the Colombians, but also for the Cubans as well, to show that, you know, rather than encouraging instability in the Americas, they're actually encouraging stability and helping people reach, hopefully, a peaceful settlement, this long, long civil war in Colombia. And so I would argue that I think, I really, like Stephen mentioned, there's this upcoming Summit of the Americas meeting in Panama, and I think this is a perfect opportunity for Obama, now that the midterms are over, to maybe to start rebuilding this relationship with Cuba and hopefully kind of help regain the U.S. leadership role in the hemisphere that has been so damaged by this policy.
Good. Well, thank you very much. So, as I hope, we have at least 20 minutes left for questions, plenty of topics raised, and who would like to be the first? Yes. Do you need, can you just maybe stand up? Yeah, is that okay? Do we need a mic?
I didn't need it.
Yeah.
Hello. I was... From what I've been hearing from you,
You have underlined the importance for the U.S. of regaining relations with Cuba, but how would it benefit Cuba so much that these relations are regained?
Okay, can we take maybe a couple more? We'll take them together.
I
want to
know what's going on in the New York Times. Okay. I mean, it just really, it feels like a clip. Anybody knows that?
Yeah.
Hello, as yes. Professor Haywood had mentioned, I am a research assistant for the Cuban Global Relations, and I just... So what we have been noticing is that in the libraries of Cuba, and Professor Haywood has some of the books in the office, and I've been doing some research with these books, is there's a lot of Cuban patriotism in these novels, in these works, biographies and autobiographies based on the Civil War. Movies such as Can Gamba in 2008 came out, and so my question is that as Professor Stephen mentioned that Cuba's starting to develop back into, it's becoming more open to the world, as you mentioned. And my question is, could these patriotic books and accounts kind of try to reposition the Cuban patriotism and kind of maintain that, you know, that revolutionary mentality that it had in the 1970s? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much. Perhaps I could ask Stephen to address the first one. What's the Cuba angle in terms of their gain from a recast relationship with the U.S.?
Well, first of all, I'm curious about the New York Times myself. ever since I left there, I haven't even set foot in the new building, so I'm really cut off from them after more than 20 years as a New York Times correspondent. I guess... when the New York Times comes out so strongly in favor of a policy, it really is, it's not the beginning. That's the end phase. By the time the New York Times has grabbed onto it, then you really think it must have grabbed the mainstream. So I find that encouraging, but I also find it a little puzzling. Where were they when this was important? And I guess we know the answer. I tell you, the question about what better Cuban-American relations would mean for Cuba is actually a very rich and perplexing one. I know the Cubans, they lust after it, but they fear it. Mm-hmm. And they're right in both impulses. There is such economic, not to mention political power in the United States compared to Cuba, it's easily imaginable that Cuba becomes completely overrun. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing but a McDonald's and a Kentucky Fried Chicken on every corner. And whatever distinguished Cuba from the rest of the Caribbean basin over these last 50 years will evaporate. And that's not all good. So I sense that the Cuban diaspora is now much more interested than it has been in the past in trying to bridge this gap. I think that diaspora has a great deal to offer Cuba, including economically. And I think the diaspora has come along, has evolved politically as generations have changed. Nonetheless, I think there are two fears in Cuba. First of all is this economic tidal wave. And I think there's also a fear of what politically lies behind that. When you allow unfettered capitalism, you're going to get exactly what Fidel Castro tried to end, which is there going to be some rich people and a lot of poor people. Those rich people, once they have economic power, it happens in every country, they want to get political power. That sets in motion a new dynamic. And if I were advising the Cuban government, I would tell them that reconciliation with the United States, is, in the abstract, is a good idea, but be very careful with it. And just to add one other observation, I think it's quite true that Cuba has emerged as something of a leader in Latin America. I tell you, it truly is amazing to go into the most remote, impenetrable regions of Latin American countries, and the only foreigner in 100 miles is a Cuban doctor. You would never find a European or American doctor that's willing to live like that.
Yeah.
When they said, when Dr. Keller said they live in remote areas, she's not even conveying what this means. They don't go to work at 9 o'clock in the morning and finish at 5. This is a life commitment, and it's very impressive, and it can't help but have an impact. But I would say that from the American point of view, the rise of Cuba, the importance of Cuba now in Latin America, its relations with Mexico and Brazil, are still not important factors, because not only are we not really interested in Cuba, we're not interested in Latin America anymore. Are we going to be focusing more on the Middle East, or is it going to be East Asia now? There's a lot of debates about this. Latin America is no longer on the American radar screen. And I don't think this is all bad. You know, after the Iraq War, I remember writing a column saying that the Iraq War was one of those rare wars in which everybody lost. No winners. And I got a couple of emails from friends of mine in Latin America, and they said, you're wrong. We won. Latin America emerged as a winner from the Iraq War.
Yeah.
Because while America was so obsessed with what was happening in Iraq, we were able to do things we would have never been allowed to get away with if they were watching us the way they've been watching us for the last three generations. So let Cuba intensify its relationships within Latin America. Let Latin America strengthen itself, and maybe the United States will slowly come back to geography.
Okay. Thank you very much. The question of patriotism, would Linda, would you like to address that?
I'd like to address part of the question, the previous question, because what you see in Latin America is even more so, not in general Africa, in Angola. Angola is a petroleum-rich country with mines, diamonds. America has been there since American investments, exploration in oil. You know, I did a paper earlier that in fact spoke to this in the 1950s when they were doing it with the Portuguese, okay? Now, when I was in Angola at that time, 79, 80, I was in an elevator, and I heard Texan accent, so I said, what is this? I looked around, there were Texan oil men in the middle of the war. So they have been there right with the Cubans, right? And you have all this relationship of teaching and medical, all the medical things you talk about. You have this, it's increasing. There are 3,000 students still going to Cuba to be educated, engineering, mining. Where are the Angolan students here in America? What have Texaco, done? There is, these companies, they just have a different character. And for Cubans, it's going to be a big loss if America has any moves on in terms of, doing the things it should do to get at the stage where Cuba is in Angola. So yes, they lost not only a lot, would they lose out if America re-engineers its policy. The Angola situation is also, and America has that oil. It's very important. Now, perhaps not so, but they have natural gas also. They have other things and strategically, Angola is now taking, it said, we learned in the revolution that we can be a place for good in Africa. So we are sending our troops here, we are doing this. There's a whole kind of a kind of a continental program that Angola is in the leadership now, So I think we should take this in mind too. There's a cost to the American kind of looking again at not only Cuba, but South-South. Because don't take Brazil as an easy player. Brazil is there not only in Central Africa, but in West Africa as well, with the tour. There have been lots of money. That's $800 million that was invested. Look at what the Brazilian, it was all done secretly. Mm-hmm. Right, because they also were investing also that same business in Angola as well. So there's a whole set of tensions there. Now, in terms of patriotism, I think the patriotism is a very, when you fight a war, however reluctant a soldier you were, you're fundamentally altered by it. And it takes time for you to come to terms with what it is. And you see that war, it strengthened Cuba, and he died. Cuba has a special thing. They did it with the War of Independence, right? And where Martí becomes, in fact, reconfigured for different generations over time. and this war, right, which Cuba believes is win because it's still there with its connection, is in fact a very potent case. So I'm still trying to figure out exactly if this is for, you know, this whole thing of nationalism and patriotism, it's for propaganda. Is it independent? Is it coming from an independent source? We can't figure that out as yet because the process is still continuing. It's not a completed process. But I do believe that we have to think seriously about those Cubans who lived through from 59 to now and didn't leave and did what the government wants and their investment in them. There are lots of them who are, in fact, very they're frustrated. But what that frustration means for the future, I don't know.
Okay, thank you. I'll just add a few comments on that. On the New York Times issue, it is interesting. I think it's partly connected with a new gentleman who's joined the editorial board, Ernesto Londoño, who is a young Colombian who clearly is interested in these things and has seen maybe a market niche.
But if that's true, it really shows you how weak the institution is. Just because one guy gets hired, if he didn't get hired, we don't support that.
Well, he's obviously worked some magic because we're all talking about it. But then, a point on US investment. Yes, obviously, the US is losing out. The British were there, the Canadians have been there, and so on. One thing you have to remember is the McDonald's in every corner. Everything has to be approved by the Cuban government, whether it's from Brazil, Mexico, anywhere. So you can't just go in, and that's not going to change anytime soon. Mm. It's still very controlled, any project, even the Chinese.
Yes.
And if you're reading the newspapers last week, you'll see a Chinese investor complaining that he's been kept waiting for 4 months for his LED light bulb factory, which is supposed to be opening. Another important point is, of course, this relationship with the U.S., has benefited the Cuban government because they have, as we know, exploited the hostility. And they've done it repeatedly through the period, and that's part of the folly, in my view, of the US policy. There have been many periods when it looked as though there was a rapprochement about to happen, then Fidel did something which the Congress detested, and of course the whole thing fell apart. The issue of Alan Gross currently, you know, if the Cubans were perhaps more serious, they could have detached it and treated it as an issue, which could have shown, you know, the American Congress at least that there was scope for moving forward. So it is a complicated relationship. The medical diplomacy has been superb in building international support. And of course, you probably saw the Ebola diplomacy. The Americans were down in Havana last week, the CDC people. They're cooperating on the ground in Liberia, Sierra Leone. Just as they have in Haiti. So there is that basis now also for cooperation. But please don't forget that the Cubans have a different model. And we all admire them sending doctors very quickly to these parts of the world. Basically, they own the doctors. And of course, it's a different model for Médecins Sans Frontières. It's a different model for our friends up the road on Comav, Partners in Health, Paul Farmer's organization, where the doctors themselves have to decide. They volunteer, governments provide the money, but in most countries they don't own the doctors. So there is a difference, and if we were to be sort of rigorous in analysis, that's one thing. Right, let's take some more questions. We have a bit more time, if anybody would like to. Anybody willing, interested in speculating on the effects of the elections? Will it have no effect at all? As Stephen was suggesting, Cuba is perhaps disappearing insignificance. Nobody now cares much beyond a mojito and some good music about Cuba. Yes?
It's not particularly a question, more of a comment than I would like to hear more reflection on. What I did notice when I went to, I'm not sure exactly how the situation is recently, but when I did go to 2009, I noticed that the airport officials, especially just the officials in general of Cuba, they have this really discriminatory attitude towards the Cuban Americans. Left the country and came back. Like, I myself am Cuban American. My family came here when I was 4 months old, and when we go back, we always receive this discriminatory attitude. But then you have a lot of the tourists that, in that time, the Americans going, and there's no really discriminatory attitude going on there. So the social relationship between Cubans and Americans, or, you know, Europeans, is there. So what? The way I see it is that for Cubans, especially the ones that are going to the government, they see the United States general as this of that country, but how can that social relationship exist with the Americans? Really quick comment. When my parents went to a bank in Artemisa, which is one of the regions around Havana, they noticed that on a really big map, the United States was not there. And they asked the officer standing there, they said, why isn't the United States there? It's a big country, it's a great power. And they said, we don't affiliate ourselves with the United States. But then at the same time, when they see an American, they're really socially interactive with them. So that's something that I observed.
Yeah, sure, I could talk about that. So the first time I went, I definitely experienced that, the kind of hostility toward Americans. That I was there for 3 weeks trying to get access to the archives, and I said, well, this guy's looking at your documents. Why can't I? And they said, well, he's Canadian. Okay, I can't change that. And I was never able to see anything or, you know, work anywhere. I got nothing done. And then last year I went back, and it was totally different. You know, I was there for 1 week. They let me work right away, instead of waiting 2.5 weeks to get my visa processed. They did it overnight and then brought it to the archive for me. It was just so much more friendly and so much more open. And even on the part of bureaucrats, you know, which is always kind of this level, you know, people who I talked to generally on my first trip were friendly, but the bureaucracy was always like very stubborn. And that just wasn't the case last year. And so I think it's very recent that it's changing, and it's very incomplete, but the process has definitely started.
But I think you have to be careful with that, because in fact, in 1 week, things could change.
Sure.
So that we invited a Cuban professor here last semester to give it all, and she was all ready to go. And we couldn't get, they had cleared everything in Washington and everything else, and something happened at the State Department, or so, and they just kept up the visa. So we had to wait 2 weeks. We had, sent out all our flyers and so, and we just couldn't do it. So it's very arbitrary,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it depends on if you brush the fly here in Washington, it has its, you know, impact mm-hmm. in Havana. So
I would also add that there's a background to all this. I think Cubans and Cuban, including in the government, are realizing times are changing
yes,
and everything else has to change.
Yes.
On the other hand, don't forget that we spent decades trying to kill them. We were involved in intense activities of trying to murder their leaders. We were carrying out all sorts of violent and nonviolent covert actions there. We made no secret of our desire. We still don't, to overthrow the government there. Therefore, even if people are thinking that times are changing, there have been decades when it's been drilled into them that the United States is hostile to them, and this is true. So it's... Even the changing rational view that we need to be different because times have changed does not completely wipe away decades of history.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with that. The family connections, I think, are a reality on the ground. If you go, you know, to any U.S. airport, you go obviously to the Havana airport. I think U.S., ironically, is at number two.
Right.
In terms of all foreign visitors to Cuba
yeah.
after Canada. So, and the figures I don't think are fully reflected on. So all these connections are being rebuilt. There is de facto investment in the small businesses by Cuban Americans and in the real estate. The people who can buy the cell phones, which are now commonly seen, of course, in Cuba, are families. They're not the Cubans on their $20 a month salary. So that is the reality. And that is a challenge for the government because a lot of it's happening under the radar of the government. Is there a final question before we wrap it up? Yes,
yeah,
Jonathan.
I had a question. So, listening, I can't remember who was that said it, but someone said that they were talking about how there's a lot of new opportunities that Cuban Americans can gain from having interaction with Americans. But I think that that a big question before we can talk about how opening up to foreign investment can affect them is how we're going to deal with allowing workers in Cuba to receive benefits. I'm thinking about, I think, the Maria Harvard, where they're trying to get a lot of foreign investment. I think I read an article, but they said that that they were going to pay, you know, large amounts to the government, but they were only going to pay really
But I think you're absolutely right, and it's certainly a true fact that when a company comes to Cuba, that company, say it's a Canadian or a Spanish company, is not allowed to decide how much it's going to pay its own workers. You pay a Cuban institution, and the Cuban institution decides how much of that money they're going to give to their workers. That's part of the way the government controls the economy. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. Allowing foreign companies to pay whatever they wanted will inevitably have the effect of creating disparities, because some people are worth more. Some people can earn more money than others. Some people get jobs. Some people don't. Now, in our society, we would consider that not only natural, but positive. But I think you're right. Investment in Cuba will lift the Cuban economy, but will it lift the lives of the ordinary Cuban? I would say to a certain degree, but not nearly as much as it's going to benefit the government. That's the way the system is set up. It's set up to produce this result.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes, so I was thinking because obviously the government is going to gain a lot of revenue from this. It's going to be good for them, because obviously the people aren't going to make as much. But for the government, if they're going to allow companies that come in from different countries to actually make money without, penalizing them, because we see the Cuban government has sort of been has certain way with foreign investment. Could allow them to make money in their country, and it's sort of doing what they fear ultimately. I mean, they fear that foreign companies would come in and sort of gain sort of control over the Cuban economy. Obviously, they don't want that to happen, but they're going to need to let somebody make money if they want.
They're looking for something like a Chinese model where the state maintains control. But China's not really a good model for Cuba. China's so big. China has such an entrepreneurial history. The entrepreneurial spirit in Cuba really has been heavily, not crushed, but heavily damaged by generations of socialist rule. So I don't see that situation changing much, and I see the government looking at control over the paying of laborers and working as a middleman between foreign companies and employees as an absolute bedrock of their economy going forward.
Yeah, and I would also say, from what I've observed, I've gone four times in 4 years, so every year from 2011, in 1 year, 2 years, two times. And what I've seen over the last 4 years is that when I first went in 2011, I really didn't see prostitutes. I saw tourists. But I didn't see prostitutes. This last time, I was so disheartened. This time I spent 3 weeks. And what I saw is that these young Afro-Cuban women, not women, they were children. One of them was like, I'm sure she was 14, 13 years, because when she came into the pastelaria where I was sitting to have coffee, she actually bought this older man who came in with her, a foreigner. He's black. 50 years older than her. What did she have? An ice cream. Now, I sat down there, and I was tempted to just go up to him and say, how can you do this? This is what I fear. The tourism has an invidious consequence on the class and color structure of Cuba, that I think it's not so much the business I'm talking about, because right now you don't have to. It's the individual who is the business. The tourists, the individual tourists, and what they go to Cuba for. And yes, some middle-class people are getting in the tourism sector. They are being paid full rate. And the only way lower-class Cubans, mulattoes, mixed, darker-skinned Cuban, white Cuban, lower-class, the only way they could get that, cook hard currency is, in fact, to do it directly. And what I'm seeing now is selling one's body, and it's not the consequence. And I'm saying, why isn't the police here? All of these things I'm asking myself. Where is the police? Where's the monitoring? And I see the police all along the street going to, Havana Value. I see it, Ciudad Value. And I'm just, there is some disconnect. The society right now is not controlling what is taking place at that level, at the level of people. So that's just my comment.
Yeah, I think that's a really tough question, Jonathan, this idea of how do you distribute the benefits of investment and the benefits of labor? Because on one hand, if the state, you know, is able to control the disbursement of money, they can do it in a more equal fashion, right? But then you also have the issue of, well, then everyone's benefiting from some people's labor, and some people are benefiting without doing the labor themselves. And so it's different questions of what's fair and who's benefiting. And I think it's a really tough question, and I think it'll be interesting to see how Cuba answers it, because I don't think there is a right answer to that question. So I'm curious. I'm really curious.
They're in uncharted territory, really. Yes. Nobody's quite tried to do it this way.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That makes it all the more difficult.
Yes, I mean, just the final comment. The one problem the Cuban government has never solved is the problem of wealth creation and how much of that should be with ordinary Cubans. Mm-hmm. The government has always, of course, taken the major slice of hard currency, and that is one of the big indictments of, I mean, the 13-year-old girl forced to do that and the struggles in everyday life that Cubans have. So that's one problem they have to face. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the government is going to have to say, yes, we trust ordinary Cubans to go beyond the bonsai companies to have monies in their pocket, money in their pocket so they can invest, they pay taxes to the government. And that's the way, ultimately, the public services will have to be financed. But that's, you know, a story for the future when we meet again and discuss US-Cuba policy at BU. But thank you all for coming. It's been a very interesting event. Thank you for all those involved in organizing it. And I hope you all get the chance very soon to visit the wonderful country of Cuba. Thank you.
I'd like to say I just found out that in my course, one credit course going to Cuba this spring. It's still, so please try to spread the word and register for the course, because we have to have at least 12 to 15 students to go. But you're going to get a Cuban experience that would be, at this time, it's so important to go. Thanks very much.